Hello and welcome to episode 4 of The Office Block, hosted as always by our friends here in Headstuff and supported by the Financial Services Union, the union for people who work in banking and financial services. Thanks as always for the feedback on the show. We had some very animated responses to our last topic, which was on pay and performance at work. On our Facebook poll, 100% of voters said that companies should publish salary ranges to their staff. Interestingly, a piece I wrote myself for the journal.ie on pay and unions got a lot of traction, and they ran a poll where 56% of people said that they could see the benefits of a trade union at work. Some rather interesting comments underneath that article, though I've no idea how representative the comments section of the journal.ie is of the population at large. But good piece, and good to get such coverage and feedback. One writer who has come down in favour of trade union membership is Stephen Kinsella of the Sunday Business Post. Now, that may not be a paper which you would traditionally associate with trade unions, but he crunched the numbers and examined the evidence and concluded that joining a union was the way to get a better deal at work, and he'll be joining us shortly. Also, we have Laura Bambrick from the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, who joins us to talk about housing, pensions, and the shifting patterns of the generation game in Ireland. Are the young losing out at the expense of the old, or is our entire society being redrawn as the models of employment and public provision change? These are the questions we're teasing out today here on The Office Block. As usual, you can tweet us at the OB Tweets or find us on Facebook and Instagram. But now, Stephen Kinsella, you're welcome to The Office Block.
Stephen, tell me about the economic picture for people under 35 in Ireland and how it compares internationally.
Well, right now it's pretty good in the sense that there is employment where before there wasn't. You couldn't really expect to get a job in the same way that maybe people of my generation, you know, I'm 40, would have expected at age, say, 30. Just because employment is going up, however, doesn't mean that we should think that everything's rosy. What I'd like people to think about is that there's a long run horse race between your wages, what you get paid, and what you can afford, and costs. So things like the cost of living, and finally productivity. So when I say productivity, think about making pizzas. You know, if you're making pizzas and you make 10 pizzas an hour, and then that goes up to 12 pizzas an hour, then you're more productive as a worker, right? And it may be because you've got a better pizza making machine. It may be because you're working harder. It may be because you've got somebody shouting in your ear or whatever. But the idea in general, in the long run, is that increased labor productivity should be associated with higher wages. So if your productivity goes up by 10%, say, you should see wages going up after a little while of 10%. And that typically then you see costs going up by somewhere like 5 to 10%. So if over the very long run, now I'm talking about a century, if you have a situation where wages are keeping pace with productivity and they're keeping pace with costs, then that's a pretty good situation to be in for workers. So more or less the 40s, 50s, 60s, post-war, if you like, from let's say 1946 up to about 1973, that's pretty much the picture. So if you've ever watched Mad Men, that's more or less the world that you're in. So that's what you'd like. After about 1980, pretty much those three things diverge. So costs go way up, wages start falling, and labor productivity explodes actually in the 90s, thanks to the ICT revolution. So more or less, workers aren't taking home any of the or many of the gains in labor productivity. So that's the story, and that's gotten far worse for workers, and in particular in respect to debt. So just to give you one simple example, there's a brilliant paper by the central bank's Tara Macondo-Calder, and she computed mortgage debt burden ratios. So, but by birth cohort. So, for example, anybody, if you're young, if you're born after 1970, you're middle-aged, if you're born between the 60s and 70s, and you're old, if you were born before 1960. And what she shows is for young borrowers, the ratio of mortgage debt to income is about 3.5. And for older borrowers, it's 1.2. In other words, you are three times more likely to be indebted and deeply indebted if you're younger than if you're older. So that's a good statistic in the Irish case, that is quite helpful For us, if we like, if we try to understand the differences between households under 35 and households over 35.
And Stephen, we're roughly of the same vintage. In terms of our housing situation generally in society, how does the situation for people under 35 stack up, say, in comparison with their parents? You've drawn one comparison there in mortgages. Can you draw that out a little bit for us, please?
Well, another way to think about it is in terms of the interest share of mortgage repayments. So you typically, if you're a younger household, you're actually spending a fair whack of your income just paying mortgage repayments. Not simply that you got a large amount of debt, is that every month a certain amount of cash has to come out. And again, the interest share of mortgage repayments for those who borrowed in 2014 is about 0.41. So it's not a huge amount. But for older borrowers, it's almost half that. It's 0.25. So again, like, you know, if you just think about this, you've got people whose incomes are not keeping pace with their labor productivity, and the cost of the major item in anybody's basket, housing, is going up, and the debt servicing costs of that are going up. We have very, very expensive banks relative to the rest of Europe. So if you take out a variable rate mortgage, in Ireland right now, you're paying a lot more than the average, you know, 34-year-old in Spain or Portugal, for example.
Stephen, just to draw that point out a little bit, in the Sunday Business Post in June, you outlined a number of challenges for people of the generation you're talking about, not least in housing, which you referred to, but also in income and pensions. And you wrote, two policies will help most, increasing their incomes either by collective bargaining or by the simple supply and demand of the labour market and stabilising prices. What was the evidence for the case for collective bargaining to alleviate some of the difficulties that you outlined?
Well, there's a lot of evidence about this. One of the really big studies is by a guy called Simon Deacon and his colleagues in 2014. So they studied the link between labour laws and labour share of national income. So if the economy produces 100 pizzas, let's say, let's say $100 worth of stuff, workers in the 1970s would have taken home about 70% of that, and employers would have taken home about 30% of that. Now that's more or less reversed. Workers are taking home a decreasing share of national income. It's between 50 and 60% for most wealthy economies. And labor laws have been correspondingly weakened. So Deacon and his colleagues in 2014 studied this link. They said, they asked themselves the question, if worker protective labor laws are weakened, is that associated with falls in the labor share of national income? And they found that it absolutely was. They found the opposite as well. Stronger protective labor laws are very positively correlated with labor share of national income. And in a really recent article, Adams and her colleagues studied 113 countries, and they found that the pattern held as well. Weaker labor laws coincide with weaker growth in labor shares of national income. So this is really prevalent, not just across OECD countries like Ireland and Denmark and stuff, but actually across the majority of middle income countries as well. And so that's a really important point. Where you've got stronger labor laws, you tend to see workers taking home more of the value of what they produce.
The point of it, I think, Stephen, that I'd like to raise with you is this, that when people make that argument, it will often be put to them that the model in Ireland is antagonistic to what you say, that the sort of strong labour laws that you refer to will drag this economy down, will cause job losses. Can you respond to that argument? Because I see that all the time, particularly from, say, spokespeople for employers.
Sure. I mean, I think what one qualifying point there is that it really depends on the size of the employer that you're talking about. So many people were arguing when minimum wages were increased recently, for example, that it was going to lead to a large decrease in employment, particularly of low margin employers, so people who are barely making ends meet anyway, having to increase wages would harm them. In fact, the evidence shows that this barely happened at all. So for very small service-based, firms, this didn't happen. And for larger firms, like I said, the capital share of national income, if you like, the stuff that's going to employers, has increased massively over this period. You've got to remember that every year the size of the economy has grown, or more or less every year, over the last, say, 50, 60 years. And so even despite there being 5 years of an economic disaster here, GDP has grown a lot over the past, say, 25 years. And every time that grows and you give some of it to workers and some of it to employers, those profits end up somewhere. They can be reinvested in the business or they can be released back to shareholders. But it's very rare that workers who are working harder and labor productivity has been rising, it's very rare to see workers rewarded with one-on-one increases for their wages. So my simple answer to that would be that employers have never made more profits, and those profits are realized through the stock market, they're realized through share buybacks, they're realized through retained earnings, or they're kept through retained earnings. And those sectors have never made more money. So it's not the case that, I don't see the case, especially for middle and large firms, that increasing wages for workers would necessarily result in decreases in employment.
Stephen, can I just ask you, in terms of how we frame this debate about the generation game, about the generation gap, it sometimes worries me that we seem to be getting into a sort of very conflictual situation where we say young people are losing out at the expense of older people. Would you share my concerns about that kind of a debate, that sort of reductive debate?
Yeah, it's reductive because I think it focuses on an easily observable variable, which is a pretty common thing in public policy, you see younger people having a harder time, and like with the evidence that I've just discussed there, they're having a harder time, and because they're having a harder time, people go, oh, well, that must mean we need policies to help young people, and, you know, if you have an extra euro to give away in the budget, you should give it to young people and not old people. And so forth, and the while that is true at the margin, you know, if you're the Minister for Finance and you have to allocate, you know, that 1 euro, that is true. You're harming one and helping the other. In practice, actually, older workers have been protected from large amounts of the downturn, especially if they worked in ICT or pharmaceuticals or any of those sectors. It's not to say that they didn't take pain. Of course, every worker suffered under the years of austerity. But it's what I would prefer to think about is what is the correct balance between the apportionment of the surplus that the economy produces. Should the economy produce? Should the economy produce more value? Where does that value go, and who gets that? I think that if it's incontrovertible that we have had vast increases in labor productivity over the last 20 years, and we haven't seen increases in wages, well, that is almost certainly because of technological change. Sure, it's almost certainly because of globalization, jobs being able to outsourced and so forth. But I would imagine a large component of the lack of wage growth is the fact that unions have become weaker over time. And there's actually a fair bit of international evidence to suggest that weakening labor laws and the weakening and diminishing role of unions in the private sector is largely largely accounts for the disconnection between productivity and wages.
Stephen, that has been a fascinating interview. So thank you for joining us on The Office Block, and keep in touch. We hope to have you back on again.
Laura, you heard Stephen's interview there. What would be the takeaways from that? How would you respond to some of what Stephen was saying there?
Well, I think it's great that we're having somebody as highly regarded as Stephen, both as an economist and a columnist. He has a very large following, with somebody that's coming out so powerfully showing the premium from joining a union, both for individuals themselves, but society as a whole. He definitely is somebody that has the ear of policy decision makers. So he is, it's very exciting that he is looking at the research, and he is saying to those that are in a position to make these decisions that, you know what, supporting unions is good for everyone, for individuals on the ground and for society as a whole. And that is a message we, our membership, should be echoing and repeating every occasion possible. Family dinners, Christmas, the lot.
Laura, just you are the policy officer with the Irish Congress of Trade Unions. Can you just tell me a little bit about your role and how you ended up working for the Irish Congress of Trade Unions?
Certainly, Paul. So I would have trained as a public policy analyst and a social researcher through university. So I would have done an undergrad in social policy at Trinity and then went on to look at comparative social policy at master's level and PhD level, both at Oxford. So 10 years of looking at social policy. So I definitely have earned my stripes as a policy wonk. So from there, I went to work in policy roles internationally, have spent some time at UN headquarters and worked at the National Office of Vincent de Paul. So have some experience in the NGO sector and then worked as a research consultant with the polling agency Ipsos MRBI, which I'm sure many of your listeners would be aware of from their political opinion polls in the Irish Times.
What about, can you just tell us briefly about your experience in Oxford? Because I think it's something that our listeners might be interested in. What was your experience like there? Was it elitist?
It's a different experience if you're going as a graduate,
yes,
than as an undergrad.
Okay.
So I would have been very lucky. I had a very generous scholarship, but Oxford, no surprise, is a very expensive place to study. So even though I had that generous scholarship, I had to work my way through university. And I had this job, which sounds very glamorous. I was called a junior dean, which makes me sound like a junior Oxford don. But in Oxford terms, I was a glorified babysitter, which meant that I was responsible for 500 undergrads outside of office hours. And that was an experience where you were seeing the incredible stress 18 to 21 year old Oxford undergraduates were in, having to be high achieving, most of them coming from very high achieving family. And yes, you definitely did see the class divide at that level. Oxford is a very international university, but that tends to be mostly at graduate level, although they will have an element of an international, a lot of Commonwealth countries as undergrads will come. So it was certainly an eye-opener. Can't say I would have survived undergrad at Oxford, I don't think. Trinity was a good mini-step before I went over to Oxford, but certainly enjoyed my time there, spent 6 years there, and loved it, loved it. The rose-tinted glasses have arrived in the post. I'm 8 years out, so I look back and go, oh, they were the best days. But it was a great experience to study in a large graduate environment.
Laura, just have been following some of your work with the Irish Congress of Trade Unions. And one of the pieces of research that you did really caught my eye. As you know, we're talking about the generation game today, the differences between the generations. And you did a piece of work on housing, and I just thought the results were absolutely startling. You came up with this figure, 1 in 6 people who are in work, and bear in mind that these are workers, you know, who work in places which are union jobs, are in arrears with rents. That's 1 in 6 in arrears with rents of people who are at work under 35. Tell me more about the findings of that survey.
Certainly, Paul. So Congress conducted a national opinion poll last month of 1,500 trade union members under the age of 34. So young workers, that's the definition, anyone under 34, on their housing costs. And the reason for this piece of research was allow us to measure, to quantify the impact of the housing crisis on a generation of people who are sandwiched between high housing costs and low wages, to allow us to look behind those snappy terms like generation rent and delayed adulthood. And as you mentioned there, yes, the findings are stark. We found that 2 in 5, 40% of all young workers are spending over 30% on their rent. Now, the 30% rent to income ratio is an internationally recognised measure of housing affordability. If you're spending more than 30 euros for every 100 euros you have in income, that is considered to be unaffordable. So unsurprising that, or I should mention that worryingly, 1 in 10 of those young workers are spending over half of their wages on rent. So as I started there, unsurprisingly, when we asked them how are they managing, we found that 1 in 2 of all young workers are struggling to cover their housing costs, having had to borrow or to sacrifice another basic need. So that's not being able to go out on Thursday or Sunday night. That's going without food, heating, maybe transport, no longer able to run a car in order to pay their rent in the past year. Now, because this situation is unsustainable in the long term, we can live without our means for a month or two and manage to catch up. But if it's our housing and we're doing it over the medium to long term, it's unsustainable. So it was no surprise that 1 in 6 of those people that are struggling are falling into arrears. So in fact, that would be 1 in 12 of all young workers. The figure you mentioned there is 1 in 6 of the 50% of those who are struggling that are falling into rent.
Were you surprised at the stark results of that survey, Laura?
We really were. Like, as you mentioned yourself, these are unionised workers who, as Stephen mentioned, they have better terms and conditions. There is a premium associated with being a member of a union or working in a unionised job. A person that isn't in a union or in a unionised job that is doing work similar to yours of equal value will by and large be earning less and have less favourable conditions than you. The workers we also interviewed, our workers, 80% of them had permanent contracts. 80% of them were working full-time hours. So these weren't the precarious workers. These weren't people on if and when contracts. Another point to make is that 3 in 4 of the 1,500 people we interviewed don't have children. Mm. So they have no bigger outgoing. So really, as stark as these findings are, these are the best of the worst situation.
The best of the worst situations, and it's still pretty bad.
Very, 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 very stark. Now, one piece, one light at the end of the tunnel is that over 8 in 10, 84% of all young workers that we survey said that housing will influence how they vote.
Laura, can I just take you on to the solutions? They would appear to me to be twofold. One would be reducing costs generally for people, and the other is in rising incomes. One of the things that worries me is that drift into generalisations and the generational blame game that takes place when these issues are discussed. Let's face it, not everyone over 35 is doing very well. How do you feel about that juxtaposition?
Absolutely. So people age over 65 are 4 times less likely to experience poverty than the population as a whole. Those most at risk of living in poverty are children and adults of working age that are living in jobless households. Mm. A jobless household is where nobody is working, or they're working what us wonks call low work intensity. They're only working the few hours. Mm. Now, if you're born into one of these poor families, the odds of your poverty and your disadvantage following remaining with you through adulthood are starkly high, and vice versa. If you're born into privilege, the odds of your privilege remaining with you throughout your adulthood are very high. disadvantage and privilege don't magically disappear once people reach pension age. Today's poor children are highly likely to be poor pensioners tomorrow. Also, believing that the generation before you had it easier is another trap people often fall into. Housing prices are 7 times higher today than they were for our parents when they were young workers. And yes, a family could afford to buy a family home on one income. And that's just as well, because if I was a young worker in the 1970s, I would have been barred from most good jobs. Mm. I would have had to give up my job in the banking sector. I would have had to give up my job in the public sector. And equally, for young workers who weren't able to afford to buy in the 1970s, there were large housing marches in the 1970s against a lack of social housing, against chronic overcrowding, against poor quality housing. Again, many of us fall into the trap of thinking everything is unique to our age. No, there weren't children living in hostels and hotels and hubs back in the 70s. That's unique to us. But instead, they were locked up in Magdalene laundries or they were banished to the UK. So we need to be mindful that it's not all rosy in the garden for any one group of people, or there wasn't a golden age.
Yeah, because it does seem that when we debate these issues, the generational game, the generational differences, that we often do drift into a sort of a war of all against all, where you start pitting generations against each other. So that's an interesting set of circumstances. That's an interesting, set of comparisons that you've brought up. Can we move on to pensions for a moment? Now, when I mention pensions, I have this general fear that people will shut off, because it's not always the most tantalising of subjects. But the truth is that for a great many of young people at work today, they don't have a pension provision. And the picture is, you know, particularly bleak for people in their 20s and 30s.
Absolutely, Paul. I understand your fears about your listeners tuning off. The former General Secretary of Congress and now the head of the pension authorities, David Begg, has a great saying. He says that pensions is a boring topic to anyone under 40. By 50, the topic becomes mildly interesting. And at 60, it's riveting. Now, unfortunately, by 60, it's too late to undo the damage from our pensions inertia. So, yes, you're right. Less than half of all workers have an occupational or private pension to supplement their state pension. And while young workers are less likely to have a pension to pension cover than older workers, and that gap is growing bigger over time, the real divide is between public sector and private sector workers. 90% of public sector workers have a second tier pension, compared to a mere 35%, one in three in the private sector. So why is this? Well, there are three main reasons. The one is the low union density in the private sector, and that low density is getting worse over time. The second reason is government have tried to address this through generous tax relief to encourage people on low and middle income incomes to voluntarily take out a private pension, and that has failed. It's not working, despite it costing the Exchequer $1.3 billion a year. That's a failed policy. The third reason for the low coverage is that there is no legal requirement on employers to establish or contribute to an occupational pension, and fewer of them are doing it over time. So, as the state pension is paid at a flat rate, it's not related to how much you earn. Workers are exposed to a significant drop in their income if they don't have that second tier pension. The state pension is currently valued at just over 12,000 euros a year. So that's going to be a significant drop for anybody earning over minimum wage. If you're earning minimum wage, the state pension will provide you with 65% replacement ratio. So what are the government doing to address this? Well, they're currently in the process of preparing to introduce a mandatory retirement savings scheme, which is expected to be in place in the next 4 years in 2022. So what that will mean is that all employers will be compelled to enroll their employees into a savings scheme, a retirement savings scheme, and contributions will be made, taken from the employee's wages, matched by the employer and by the state. This has been very successful in Australia, New Zealand, the UK, countries that have similar pensions, social insurance contributions to us.
Interesting point, Laura, but just park it for a second, because a thing that I'm very aware of and conscious of is the amount of pension funds out there which employers are closing down. Mm-hmm. And the lack of government action on that just seems really, really stark.
Absolutely. One concern we have, although Congress do support in principle this move to compelling employers to contribute to the future income of their workers, our fear would be an auto-enrollment scheme will hurry up the pace of the number of employers closing down their schemes. So while we do agree in principle, we do have concerns about a number of the design features that are going to be. And one of those will be that this doesn't replace that. If we set rates at X amount, employers will look like, oh, well, that's what we're expected to do. And if they, by chance, are contributing more, it will drag that down. It will create not only a floor, but employers will see that as a ceiling. They won't go above it.
It's become just a really interesting, I find it's a really interesting topic. I know that it doesn't often capture a large audience for a number of reasons. But before I leave the, before we depart from the topic, many people who are, say, in their 20s and 30s in work now are facing situations where they don't have good pension provision. And I would see pensions as deferred wages. And many employers are trying to get out of their responsibilities of providing for pensions. And of course, we've seen the increase in the pension age, and we've seen the situation where we're talking about with a lot of pension funds closing. But it seems to me that often we get into this sort of a generational divide where younger people start saying, oh, look, those guys have pensions, we don't have pensions. I'm wondering, what is the solution in terms of, can we get a cross-generational approach to some of these issues? Can we build in some, if I can use that word, solidarity across the generations? Because young people now will one day be middle-aged, and eventually they'll be old. So you can't simply take away from older people and expect that it'll be transferred to young people. And then when those young people get to become older, those provisions are
that
not as strong.
Cycle.
That vicious cycle.
Yeah. Well, personally, I don't see generational blame as being a live issue in Ireland. The empirical evidence would show that the impact of the financial crash was less severe on pensioners as a whole. That's not to say there wasn't individuals that were impacted, and that the vast majority of people, voters, are okay with protecting the living standards of older people. If anything, the public discourse is about bashing pensioners of the future, us, the workers now. They're saying that we're living too long, there's going to be too many of us, there aren't going to be enough workers to pay for our pensions. So government is in the process of addressing this through various policy initiatives, and one of them is pushing out the retirement age. So the retirement age increased from 64 to 65 back in 2012, and it will increase again to 67 in 2021, and it will increase then furthermore to 68 in 2028. So that will put us on course for having the highest pension age in the developed world. Now, this is happening, pension age increases are happening all in many countries, especially in the developed world. But what's interesting about Ireland is we have the youngest population in the EU. We've the youngest population, and we are on course to have the highest pension age at 68. So Congress thinks putting in place supports that will help people who want to and are able to work for longer are to be welcomed. But we do have concerns with those workers who are going to be financially compelled or not fit enough to continue working beyond 65 as a result of this increase in the state pension age. And the two options the Department of Social Protection have put forward is either that you claim job seekers allowance for those additional years. Now, job seekers benefit is €45 less a week. So if we're going to take €45 away from people over 65, those group of pensioners we're saying that are less likely to suffer poverty are going to be living in poverty once we take €45, especially if they don't have that second tier.
Laura, it has been absolutely brilliant to have you on The Office Block. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Very interesting.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
I hope to have you on again.
I hope to be here.
Thanks again, Laura. Cheers.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today on The Office Block. Thanks to the Financial Services Union. Thanks to this Head Stuff for hosting us. Thanks to James, our producer. We'd also like to thank Laura and Stephen who joined us today on The Office Block. And as I said, if you've got any interesting ideas or topics or guests that you'd like to hear on The Office Block, please drop us a line at any time. Our poll is now live on our Facebook page. And the question is, are the younger generations losing out at work? So please head over to our Facebook page, The Office Block, and vote in that poll. So thanks for listening, and talk to you soon.